everyone's blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favored on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love and sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try hope. Take a chance on love, register to vote. Money ain't everything, but you could buy her a ring. Listen to little blackbird sing.
Welcome to the Coon Round Report. That's Soonchi Ali, homeboy by Soonchi Ali. Welcome to the Coon Round Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from the Coon Round Studio. If you have any questions and comments, put them in the chat. Now this week on the Coon Round Report, I will have a conversation with prolific playwright George Corbin. Playwright George Corbin is a proud member of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. George has had 4 full-length plays produced, which include Salvador Morning, Daughters of the Kush, New Man, The Wrong Kind of People, and numerous short plays. He's a member of the Roby Theater Company Advanced Playwriting Program. George, welcome to the Coon Round Report.
Well, thank you. My friends who look on Facebook say I don't smile enough, so don't take offense. welcome, and pleased that you tuned in, and hopefully you'll learn a little bit about me and a lot about you.
Mm-hmm. All right, George, the first thing we're going to talk about, we're going to get a little into your background. We're going to talk about Bermuda. You know, can you tell our listening audience about Bermuda, you know, growing up there, et cetera?
Okay. This is Bermuda, a tiny little speck in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, about 700 miles off the coast of North Carolina, 24 square miles. Looks like a fish hook, don't you think? Right there in the middle of the fish hook is where I was born, August 21st, 1943. 2 years and I'll be 80. Wow. Bermuda is unique in so many ways. My experience in growing up in Bermuda with my family, my father, who was in medical school at the University of London in 1937, when my mother was over to the Queen's coronation and as the head of the Girl Guide representatives. And he used part of his tuition to buy a ring, lock her in other words. And unfortunately, a year and a half later, the war broke out, 1939. He was about halfway through, and they asked the medical students to return to their country of origin. So he had to return to Bermuda. And that was the greatest disappointment of his life, because he got married, had a family. He was in New York in school. He never went back to complete his medical school. My mother, who's an MBE, for those of you checked out my Facebook postings, you will know it means member of the British Empire. And she received that personally from the Queen in 1978. There they are on a cruise with our daughter, Michelle. And I've forgotten the year when Michelle tunes in, she can probably remember. Anyway, my mother was a teacher for 41 years, numerous charitable groups, Girl Guide leadership, accomplished pianist and organist, choir director, you name it. My father was the athletic person. He was the tennis champ of Bermuda in the 50s, mid-50s. So I didn't follow him with that genetic material. This is a picture of Lynn and George dining on something on the water. We've had so many cruises, et cetera, we have lost track. Mm-hmm. By the way, the reason I was born in Bermuda, my grandmother, who graduated from Lincoln Nursing School in 1911 in Philadelphia and specialized in midwifery, when she returned to Bermuda, she got married to my grandfather. And she couldn't practice because of segregation as far as the hospital. She got fed up, persuaded my grandfather to move to New York. She got a job right away at the hospital in Harlem, and my father became a porter on the railroad. Mm-hmm. And my father was born in 13, and my aunt 2 years after. They got fed up and concerned with the great pandemic of 1918, so they moved back to Bermuda. Here's a picture of Canty, as we call my younger brother, Charles, who's a patent attorney, retired, mechanical engineer, and a lapsed alpha. We're getting him back as he's moving to Denver from Bermuda. The young lady there was a caregiver of my mother for several years, and they became like mother and daughter. And it was so much fun watching them enjoy life together. And as a result, my mother made it to a month short of 104.
104? Woo, that's a long time. Yeah. You know, that George, that remind me, you know, my mom's just passed last September. She was 101. See, so that's a long time. Go ahead with this picture.
This is a picture of my youngest brother, Michael. Michael died, 25 years ago. He followed me to Penn State, I don't know, about 6 years after I graduated. He got his undergraduate degree and his master's at Penn State. He majored in communication, and you can see him here applying his learning and interviewing Bill Cosby, as I posted, Bill Cosby before we became aware. And he did, he enjoyed that work in radio, primarily at Little TV in Bermuda.
Mm-hmm. So George, let me ask you a question. You know, when people think about Bermuda, they talk about the Bermuda Triangle. Is it the weather? Is it really that tense in that area?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, was written as a result, supposedly, when the sailors who were sailing to Jamestown would encounter sudden squalls and storms in the locale of Bermuda. And the reason why is pretty simple. The Gulf Stream comes up from Mexico around the coast and goes north. And it's like this highway of warm water going through cold water. And that triggers these squalls and other things. Remember, Bermuda is the tip, supposedly, of the triangle, not the whole triangle. It's just the tip. It's like that. It's not an equilateral triangle down to Miami and so forth.
Who was the sailor Juan V. Bermudez? Who was that?
Bermuda. You said, I think you saw him as Spanish, but I believe he was Portuguese. Candy, are you online yet? Sailing west, encountered Bermuda. The early sailors didn't. It wasn't saddle. There were wild hogs who survived shipwrecks. So they became prolific. So there was good food, good barbecues, let's put it that way. And ultimately, 1515, and then 1609, it was settled by the British. They ultimately brought slaves. Usually slaves weren't brought from directly from Africa. They'd go to Barbados and then they brought up sometimes the United States. There were also Native American slaves who were brought from New England into Bermuda. So it's one part of the island, which is St. David's. And I remember as a kid referencing Mohawks. You know, they were the Mohawks. Well, they were integrated, but they were lighter skinned blacks who had Native American blood. So the interesting difference between slavery in Bermuda and the West Indies was, unlike Jamaica, the Bahamas, and other places, sugarcane was not a principal crop. There wasn't enough room. It wasn't the type of weather. So the slaves became shipbuilders, sailors, carpenters, tradesmen. And thus, in 1934, with emancipation, they were able to make the transition easier because they had more education. They could read and write, and they had some skill sets. Unlike Jamaica, which suddenly had, you know, 80-90% of the population suddenly set free without those skill sets. So that's a little difference. Mm-hmm. However, the most important thing I want to tell you about growing up in Bermuda, I had a beautiful time. Bermuda was the safest and the prettiest place you can imagine. And on the surface, it was Shangri-La. However, I wrote the play Blue Marble, the Blue Marble, based on this subtle, but a subtle aspect that permeated Bermuda. And that is that whites and blacks, even though they're squeezed into a very small place, didn't live together. They had separate, it was segregated up until about 1961. I went to segregated schools. We had passed a mile away a white high school, or this elementary school. We just, it wasn't stated as such, but I remember having to go to the movies and sit in the upper balcony, just like in the South. The difference is you had the violence in the South. The British like to think of themselves as being benign, so benign discrimination. So if you wanted a job in the post office selling stamps, and you were in black at, when I was a kid, you couldn't get that job. If you wanted to start a business which would conflict or with a white-owned business, you couldn't get that bank loan. Now, my great-grandfather was a very successful businessman, but he used whites as a front to acquire property and large warehouses and such. And just like in the South, and he was very, very successful. Trent sent three of his daughters to university, one a dentist graduating from Harvard in the 30s, one to pharmacy school, Howard again. Very unusual for a woman, much less a black woman, to graduate in those professions. And my grandmother, who was an RN, the boys didn't get such treatment. One managed the stable of the horses. One piloted a small boat to go out to the ships coming in.
Look, a couple of things I wanted to ask you before we get into you heading to Penn State. Can you talk a little about your relative who was a golf pro?
Oh, yeah. My great uncle, Kid Corbin, there's a 20-minute documentary, I think most of you know this, on my website. Anyway, he was a Bermudian, but he became a pro, and he played in the Northeast, in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Canada. And he was quite a guy. He was pushed for change. He was a sharp dresser, a hit with the ladies. He wrote columns about golfers in Cleveland in the paper. In 1939, that year, he was the pro teacher for Joe Louis. But he pushed to have blacks to enter the PGA at the time. It became such a pest, they supposedly lifted his visa and sent him back to Bermuda and said, you can't come back for 6 years. So,
okay, let's get into, tell our listeners, how did you get to Penn State? You know, lay the foundation for that, for Penn State.
Very quickly, going to university as the eldest of three boys, they had to look at money. Of course, I didn't, my parents did. And social change didn't come from those who attended university in England. They replicated the British system. The high school principal of my high school, the Berkeley Institute, he was a cousin, distant cousin of mine, and he went to Oxford and Cambridge. And he came to me at 14, like you see on PBS, you know, with the kids in the boarding school, last time someone touched me, but for throwing darts in the blackboard. But they weren't pushing to change segregation that much. It was the rude men or young rude boys and girls who attended U.S. universities. And they came back, power to the people. And actually, they were supported with some of our immigrants from the West Indies. One of the most important is Dr. Gordon, who was from Jamaica. And he led the mission to change. And they held They shut Bermuda down. They basically didn't go to the movies, didn't go to the marches, the usual.
Mm-hmm.
And a very short, there was some violence, some burning of cars and so forth. But in a very short order, the Queen and her minions snapped their fingers and no more segregation. And a very gradual integration of schools.
Well, tell me, did you get a scholarship to Penn State? Did you have to pay your way?
No, my father was very bright. He got a scholarship to medical school. He was the technical scholar. My middle brother, Candy, if he comes on, he was the bright one in terms of technical skills and science. I'm just a emotional intelligence type of person. I see my friend Genevieve smirking there and laughing.
Well, let me ask you this.
Outstanding. So I picked Penn State because I needed a large university to figure out where I wanted, what I wanted to do. I was close enough to the East Coast, I could fly back home from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I ended up going to Penn State. And my brother, I took him to Toledo University to enter. I remember to this day, my parents made me drive him to Toledo and enroll him in the university in engineering. So, and then I told you, my youngest brother followed me to Penn State, undergraduate and master's.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me, a couple more questions. How was, when you hit Penn State, was it a culture shock on campus? How was it your first years there at Penn State? Was it many Blacks on campus?
There were 127 out of 24,000. I don't think I ever took a class with another Black student. Obviously, they depended on the programs you were in. But so we had the Deltas, the AKAs, the Kappas, and Alphas, obviously. And
well, let's get into that. Before I ask you that, off the side, was Joe Paterno, was he there yet, or he came later?
Joe Paterno came the year after I graduated, and 1966.
Mm-hmm.
I have pictures with he and Lynn talking and being buddy-buddy. This is before, of course, we discovered all the other stuff. Yes.
Now, let me ask you this. When we were producing New Man, and you know, you moved the setting to Africa, with the student who went there. Was that a composite of you, of your experience?
A little bit. Obviously, my life as a student and at Penn State, we had our own house. Not many Black fraternities had their own house, so my experience, the characters in my play were taken from a little bit of this brother and a little bit of this brother. In fact, I talked to a couple of them a day or so ago. This idea of seeing them 50 years later or 30 years later, and it's like yesterday, same personalities.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. What was it about? Did you join the fraternity your freshman year? What year?
End of my freshman year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got some pictures that's being projected. You want to talk a little about your experience with your fraternity?
This picture is actually some of my fraternity brothers of our alumni chapter here in Ventura County.
Yes.
And Genevieve recognizes a few of them. Sitting down is the former mayor of Thousand Oaks, Larry Horner. He was mayor three times in the rotation back in the 80s. To the right is Brother Quick, who's on screen, who's president of our chapter and a graduate of UC Santa Barbara.
Quick.
And of course, my very good friend, Everett Garman, who retired a couple of years ago as the finance guy for the city of Ventura. And then Jerry, they are our current crop. We have a much larger chapter than these few brothers here.
Yeah, we have a couple more pictures.
We are the old ones.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, did they have, I know the Alphas is, the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity is one of the old, did they have the Kappas and the Qs, was they on campus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What made you choose the Alphas?
Very similar to what you saw in my play when the African brother said, one day somebody came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, you look like Alpha material. I was a sharp dresser during my freshman year. This was Ozzie and Harry. For those of you who don't know who Ozzie and Harry, look it up on Wiki. I actually wore a tie for most of my freshman year. This was a very conservative period, like the 60s. And after I graduated, it changed totally. When my brother got there, it was smoking the marijuana, and it was and it was the hippie type dress. So anyway, I was approached, and they kind of said, I hear you're a pretty good student. And I said, yeah, I'm a very good student. And I didn't tell them that based on my high school background, under the British system, with the intense memorization, history, writing, it was like repeating the first 2 years. The first 2 years of college, it was like repeating high school. So they were impressed. Anyway, I knew a little bit about Alpha. Go ahead, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Here's our graduate chapter again, attending one of my plays after the play, The Wrong Kind of People. I notice Mr. Quick is always in the picture.
He's sharply dressed.
James Joyce, the tall one, is running for mayor of Santa Barbara. This is our Ventura County chapter.
Mm-hmm. So George, let me ask you this. Did you know a lot about Paul Ropes, W.E.B. Du Bois, all of your Alpha brothers then who was so outstanding? What was it about them that made them join the Alphas?
I knew about W.E.B. Du Bois because he was a founding member of the NAACP, and my great aunt Gussie was a lifelong member. And she had mentioned that and talked about the history and W.E.B. Du Bois. But I gotta tell you, I don't remember hearing at all about Paul Robeson. Mm-hmm. And it's only when I got involved with the fraternity and learning as a pledge a history of Alpha and the great men who were members that I really started to pick up on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, two things I want to get into. Now, I want to ask you, and then we're going to open up to also to Brother Quick, also to Brother Christian, who is the biggest challenge for the Black fraternities in this day and age. Because for a long time, it was a big distance between the middle class and the rest of the Black population. There's a number of books that dealt with it. Black Bourgeoisie by E. Franklin Frazier talk about it. Stolen Legacy by James, all of them talk about it. And these, James was an Alpha himself, one of the best books. And what is the biggest challenge for the Black fraternities and sorority in this day and age? And then I want you to introduce Brother Christian. But let's talk about that for a minute. I want Brother Quick to also chime in on that.
Are you asking me what I
think? Both of them. I'm throwing it out. The biggest challenge.
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest challenge is to engage undergraduates and millennials in terms of committing, because we have a commitment, not just to enjoy Animal House as an undergrad, but we're talking about a lifetime commitment to social programs, mentoring, voting, on and on. I think it's particularly challenging because there are so many young African-Americans and other minorities who know very little about history. As, for instance, I was teaching a class at Cal Lutheran, and I would pass this Black guy who's a junior. He had never heard of Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and he was graduating in English or history or something like that. And you have to get people where they are. I think today it's so much more challenging for young people in terms of their future economically. Life is just more difficult. They may not realize it, but those of us who live through a different era, for instance, I've worked for one company for over 37 years, and I have a fully funded retirement program. I have group insurance. I have a 401k. That was part of the package in exchange for a long career and doing a good job. Okay. So that went away like the dodo bird. It is different. I think juggling all of these. That's how do you engage these young men, parts of fraternity, with the challenges out there today? Think of last year. Think of the job situation. I want to join a fraternity, but I got to get a job. It's tough.
Let me move over to Brother Quick. What do you think is the biggest challenge?
Well, first, Brother Johnson, I want to say thank you for this opportunity. It's a wonderful platform. I bow down and pay homage for the hard work and the conscious efforts you do to educating and giving exposure and opportunity of discussion. I think that's actually, kind of one of the missing elements of our community that disconnects us. And that's understanding one another, understanding the legacy and traditions of our culture, and having the candid opportunities and conversations to educate one another. The fraternity was established at a PWI, back in 1905, 1906. When the social studies group started in 1905, those students that were there were an experiment. They were an experiment from the Black community that was privileged enough to go and educate themselves at a PWI. And in doing so, you know, of course, you know, the institution of racism was alive and prevalent then. So they had to be very discreet about what they do. They had to educate themselves. They had to cultivate themselves and had to build themselves up so that they can try to make a difference in their lives as well as the community in which they came from. Now, being at Cornell University, everybody knows it's an Ivy League school. So if they're going to, you know, cast an experiment, they're not just going to send anybody to that university. So these were brilliant minds, brilliant young men that were between the ages of 18 and 21 at the time, who took the time to find each other, mobilize themselves, and realize that first and foremost, our foundation is going to be based on brotherhood, meaning that we have to find ways to survive in this hostile environment. We have to look out for each other, and we have to, you know, work together collaboratively. Secondly, we have to educate ourselves to elevate ourselves in a way where we can go back to our communities and make a contribution and make a difference, as well as pull others forward. Mm-hmm. And so going from Cornell, when the organization was established and founded in 1906, going over to Howard University, where a good majority of the African-American community was, that was a way of them planting that seed and teaching those traditions and reconnecting us so that we could understand the importance of our existence and our community. And I think that that thrived and thrust the community forward. As a result of that, other organizations were established, meaning the NAACP was established for that, so that they can empower themselves to stand up against the racist institution that they were experiencing and that was taking the lives of many members of their community. Well, mm-hmm. not a lot of young people today understand that. Not a lot of young people understand the work and the messaging that you guys put in plays and the things that you bring to the stage, which connects the cultural existence of our, of who we are. We don't, there's a disconnect and there's a gap. And so it's connecting those dots. If we're able to get back to that, where we're able to sit down and we have a griot sit around us and give us the history of the decades and how everything has come to pass, we take that knowledge and we plant the seed with the next generation, then we could probably make a difference. But there's so many things that distract us. Social media has really, really poisoned our minds, unfortunately, in a way where it keeps us off the focus of the objectives and keep us looking to the left. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one area.
Excuse me.
Oh, in a minute.
Brother
Hold
Christian
on.
Nodding his head with mm-hmm. your points. Brother Christian is one of our newest brothers who successfully joined our fraternity. He's a junior at UC Santa Barbara, and he's Latino. And so
let me ask him a couple questions.
And questions related to
what, let me ask him a couple questions.
Sure.
And then I also want the doctor and Charlotte to, I'm interested in what's happening up in Canada in terms of fraternities and sororities. You familiar with anything up there? But yeah, let me get into Kristen. Now, I also think, the vice president? Wasn't he also the first white to join the Alphas or something like that? Herbert,
He was a dentist in 1947, was it?
I forgot. No,
Hubert Humphreys.
Hubert Humphreys, that's Humphreys, what I'm thinking about. Yeah, the vice president that also joined the Alphas. But yeah, right. Let me quickly move over to Kristen. What was your inspiration for joining the Alphas?
I love telling the story. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. Thank you, Brother Kevin, for the shout out. Also to my brother Quick out there, you know, great explanation. For me, I'm from Inglewood, California, which is in LA. It's a low income, black and brown majority community. And for me, the most inspirational person and the reason I even made it to college was because of an alpha who attended UCLA, who would come and put in countless hours of work at our high school. When a lot of people didn't. There wasn't a lot of support. There wasn't a lot of people who mentored. And, you know, I had other mentors from other different Divine Nine communities, like the Qs and the Kappas, but the most impactful and the one that left the biggest mark on me was an Alpha. And, you know, I got exposed to a variety of different Greek lives, which included Latino Greek life. But I felt that the work they were doing did not align with the work that I felt like I wanted to do. And I wanted to pay it forward to, you know, all my mentors. And Brother Quick was the reason he poured into me. And he taught me about the history and the work of Alpha. And I strongly believe that, you know, if we work to solve the issues in the Black community, it also works to solve the issues of people of color in general.
What I found interesting is, and we're going to talk about, because I know we've been going longer than an hour today because we have a lot of things to discuss. But what I really find interesting, and we're going to talk about it when we get to Salvador Morning, about bringing the Latino and Black community working together as a unit. The last time.
I'm sorry, but mm-hmm. I need to, since we left, we're touching on the fraternity sorority. One of my friends, Dr. Genevieve Taylor, who's the assistant to the president of Cal State Northridge, has been gracious again to support me. She and her family have seen, I think, all of my plays. But the important part, she's a member of a sorority called, we would call it Alpha Phi. They call it Alpha Phi. And she handles leadership training every summer.
We're going to get to her next, George. We're going to get to her and Charlotte next. As soon as I say this, we're going to we're going to open up for them to chime in on sororities and fraternities. But let me say this: the last time the Black community, the Africans, and the Hispanic came together, they actually educated the whole world. When you're talking about Islamic Spain and Islamic North Africa that set up the whole university system that we're using now. And I hope something come out of that, especially in a place like Los Angeles. But we get into that when we get into Salvador Morning. Let's go to Dr. Taylor and then Charlotte chime in. Both of you chime in on what we're talking about, these sororities and fraternities, before we leave here. You want to pick up Charlotte or Dr.
I'll chime in first because yes. So hi everyone, I'm so grateful to be here. Just a little background, I have been an actor as well as production side for both Melvin and Mr. George on several productions that they have put on in LA. I'm currently in Canada and that's where I was born and raised. But in regards to fraternities and sororities, when I was growing up, that was nothing, knew nothing about them. It was nothing that anyone that I knew, we didn't have any of the predominant Black specific fraternities and sororities in Canada. In the universities, they did have a lot of, they do have sororities and fraternities, but not historically Black ones that I was aware of growing up. It was only until I did my undergraduate at Tulane University in New Orleans that I was introduced because I was a track athlete and one of the young ladies on the team was a Delta. And she wanted, just like George was saying, tapping on the shoulder, come on, I think you're a good prospect. But for myself, I think I was very ignorant because I didn't grow up understanding the historical context of belonging to any sorority. So it wasn't something that I pursued. But recently, because there has been many Canadians who have studied in the United States and many who have joined fraternities and sororities, one of my friends who is a Delta just let me know, she wanted me to know that they are doing a line in Toronto so that there's still that tap on the shoulder that, since I'm here because of COVID right now, being close to my family. So that is my whole experience with it. But now as I've grown in my adult life, I do see the importance, and I love a lot of the work that I see, specifically the deltas, because that's the story that I am most familiar with.
Okay.
That they do. So that's
all right. On that. Thank you, Charlotte. Dr. Kelly, you want to chime in?
Just to build on what Charlotte was saying too, is the opportunity to be a part of a sorority really is an opportunity to learn more about yourselves, as well as to learn about the sisters that surround you. And I love what Deshaun said about we're here to educate ourselves to elevate others. And that is absolutely why sororities and fraternities are here. And for people to care enough about those that surround them, to tap on people like Christian and Charlotte and Deshaun and George and say, I believe in you and I believe you can be better. I see potential in you that you may not see. And I think that's the beauty of sororities and fraternities is they help you to not only be better of who you are, but really become who you were always meant to be. And they do that through education, and they do that by promoting service to others for generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me jump back over to Kristen before we move into George as a prolific playwright. I'm interested in how a lot of your Latina friends, how did they discuss you pledging?
I didn't tell them. if I'm being honest. Once they saw me with the letters, though, they were like, wow, what is that? You know, I've never seen that before. And then, you know, they start asking, and that's when I just tell them about the history, and I tell them about, you know, people mm-hmm. who are iconic within the fraternity. So I guess their reaction has been nothing but positive and in awe, and they want to mm-hmm. know more. Because I have a few people who showcase interest already, too, you know, who are like, wow, you know, like, how can I learn more about this organization?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't received any negative feedback, so, but,
okay. you know. Remember when you write your book, you was on the Coon Brown Report.
Mel,
yes.
He isn't telling you, he has a desire to get on the boards himself. In high school, he was in a lot of plays. He mm-hmm. wants to continue his acting career.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
He said to keep him in mind. By the way, there's my brother, Charles Canty Corbin. Canty Corbin.
So, yeah, we'll definitely get some comments from him later on. George, let's move into, like I said, we're going to go past an hour today. Let's talk about you as a prolific playwright. Now, you know, this is what I really like about George Corbin, Lynn Manning, Libby Lee Simon. It's the fact that they are prolific playwrights. And we need the playwright to consistently write plays for the creative artist to exist in the collaborative process. George, I want to start off. What's your process for writing? Start off there.
Well, process. I like to associate disparate elements and see whether they will coalesce into an interesting story or plot that most people, well, I'm talking about the combination of aspects of Black history that very few people know about or seem to know about, with the present, meshing, trying to figure out how to tell a story about a contemporary situation which engages the past and something interesting. And I tried to put them together, for instance, let's take care the wrong kind of people. I thought about my father telling me that when he was in New York in school, he worked at a hotel Now, he's from Bermuda, and he was shocked. Yes, he was truly shocked to see his peers who worked there smuggling out the backdoor whole turkeys and, let's say, using those, that way of taking things from the hotel and home to his their families and going through a window. So that was in the back of my mind. And then the original thing I was interested in was the racial covenant. I'd read about it, that it's the discriminatory element which was written in the transition or transaction relating to selling houses in Los Angeles. 80%, I think, in 1930 had a racial covenant, which meant if they included something like this house will never be sold to colored, Asian, Jews, whatever, that followed the house. No matter who purchased the house, he or she could not change that and sell it to, say, a Black friend or Jewish friend, whatever. That continued with the house. And it was only in 1947 that the Supreme Court overruled it. And to this day, people are, when an old relative dies, they're finding these words in the, what would you call the document relating to selling it. So I was very serious about writing a play about that. But as I started writing it, I thought, 19, just the war had just started. In LA, technically, there wasn't segregation, but there was in the hotels of discrimination. So I put them all together, and I thought it was going to be serious, but it turned out to be more comedic. The characters took the play over, but
let me ask you this:
encompass these important elements.
Let me ask you this, because most playwrights, you know, they either work from an outline, they either work from a structure, you know, with backstories, inciting incident, and conclusion. So you just take a story that's interesting to you and just drop it into the poem.
Well, first of all, I tried to see if I have a story, a plot, beginning, middle, and end. If I can't write in a couple of pages and outline the plot and story, I grind to a halt. I'm not gonna put time into it. It has to be a complete story.
Let's talk about, what's the first play? How did you get involved with the Roby Theater Company, the first play that you saw over there, et cetera? Let's talk about that for a while.
Well, the first play I wrote, and I'm glad my brother Candy was there, was New Man. I had no background, no writing experience. I had an idea for a play, and I wrote what I thought was the play. And I asked my brother, I remember being in Bermuda, and I took out this sheet of paper, and I said, hey, bro, would you read this and give me some feedback? And he, as an attorney, is very methodical and and he gave me that feedback. And later on in Los Angeles here, when I joined the Roby Theater, this was one of the plays I handed over, along with a play that I had not finished yet. And I'm the most frustrated playwright because of it, called Thunderclouds, about the black slaves of Native American Cherokee specifically.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, how do you work with a dramaturg? I think one of the dramaturgs we work over there with was Dylan. What's your approach with working with a dramaturg on your work?
I didn't know what a dramaturg was, actually, until I joined the workshop. And for the first couple of years, we'd go to the class from 10 to 1 around the table and write exercises. And then those of us who were working on a full-length play would meet individually afterwards with Dylan. And I called Dylan Mr. 80%. He would require us to submit our changes by Wednesday or Thursday so he could review them with me. He was right 80% of the time with his recommendation. So I would have a lot of homework, but it was tremendously beneficial in learning the more subtle aspects of producing a play with impact.
Okay, I'm going to mention, we're heading down where I want to end up at Salvador Morning, because we got that coming up this coming Friday. I'm going to mention, this is Salvador Morning that we got coming up this Friday. You want to say a little about Salvador, which is probably my favorite play of all of your plays, Salvador Morning. Talk about what's coming up with this.
Well, I'm a romantic at heart, and this is my attempt at a love play, a love story. And the idea of this very diverse city of ours, Los Angeles, had a real impact. I would go to my workshop, some thousand oaks, depending on the freeway. Sometimes I could be late, so I always left early. And sometimes I got there quite early. Right across the street was a small Mexican restaurant. And there was Bianca. She was a middle-aged Latina who was the waitress, assistant manager. Nobody else would be there. I would order a cup of coffee, and she was very extroverted. So we would talk about her experience in Mexico, her family going back and forth, her husband, issues relating to being an immigrant. And then it triggered something, because then Guillory, the artistic director of the Ruby, being a tall guy, he looked like, to me, the stereotypical retired LAP black detective, homicide detective. And I said, and at the time, I was discussing why isn't the Ruby Theater representing African American and the Latino Theater there, the same building, doing more collaborative works? And so I was thinking, hey, this might be a good way to do it with a love story, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what triggered that play.
Mm-hmm. Look, let's go around. Let's go around. I want to hear from your brother. I want to hear from everybody. Almost closing comments. Any questions that you have for George? And any comments that you want to make?
My closing comment for George is just, not even for George, but anyone who has the opportunity to see George's plays, to take that opportunity to learn more about George and his history and the world around us. That would be it. Thanks for the opportunity, and thanks for hosting this. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Charlotte.
Yeah, I mean, I know, I thought I knew a lot, but I learned so much more about you, Ms. George, today. And just, I thought it was fascinating when you were talking about your childhood and growing up in segregation and being a part of your play, like Newman, and obviously knowing so much Daughters of the Kush and The Wrong Type of People and other plays that I've seen of yours and been a part of. I noticed that you always create settings and scenes and themes and interpersonal relationships with a variety of people from all backgrounds, races, ethnicities, and genders in privileged and non-privileged places. So I thought, I was wondering, because you grew up in as a child in segregation, was it important that you made sure that your plays reflected a broad variety of the beautiful beauty of the human race, if that was important? And how do you think that juxtaposition with what's happening right now with social connections to, you know, humanity and within the pandemic, and of course with racial injustice that's going on right now? Long question. Or wow. Comment. Wow. So pick something
your parents were from where?
Jamaica and St. Lucia.
Jamaica. Dr. Gordon was from, as I mentioned earlier, from Jamaica. And he led the equivalent of the civil rights changes in Bermuda. And so here's a Jamaican who had a tremendous impact on this tiny dot in the middle of the Atlantic. In terms of your question, obviously our life experience impacts us. That was something I thought about. I mentioned the blue marble. That concerned me the most. How can people literally live right next to each other and live in completely different and segregated worlds? And as kids, you've heard it a million times, they don't see that early on, but suddenly through education, government, there's this split. But to me, the motivation revolves around this compression, this almost fissionable group where people of different races and ethnicities can be so close and yet so far. And that played a role. Also at Penn State, when I was there, I think the white body, the student body kind of looked at the black students as if they were foreign students, you know, because our numbers were so small in comparison to the student body. Yet many of our black students held positions of leadership, even with the small numbers on campus. Very interesting thing.
Let's go to Brother Kristen. Let me hear some of your closing comments.
Yes, thank you.
Anything you want to talk about?
I had a question for Brother Corbin. I wanted to see, right now with this digital era, you know, with things being on Zoom, what were some of the biggest challenges that you encountered with this kind of format, this new, you know, I know traditionally you might be in person, which might have a whole different feel to the play. What are some challenges with, you know, going virtual? And another thing is, did Alpha play a role in you overcoming any of those challenges?
In terms of writing plays? I missed part of it. Let me turn you up a bit. I think, like, go ahead. Say that again.
Like, what were some of the challenges that you, like, encountered specifically with the, like, anything, like, did you change anything because of having to go on Zoom? And how did you overcome those obstacles, if there were any?
Going on Zoom? I didn't do anything. There was Mel and I just sat back and and there's Michelle for technical support. I really, Mel and I are co-producers, and I listen to Mel very closely. In terms of the actual plays, yeah, we try to shorten most of the plays for Zoom. So will you lose the impact? It can. It can be an issue. On the flip side, it's an opportunity to give the actors a chance to really project in terms of the upper body and their face. They're not roaming around on stage and body language and blocking. It's all conveyed by voice and your head, your Halloween pumpkin, you know, that sort of thing.
Well,
that's fun.
Well, I tell you, brother Christian, for our generation, like me and George, and some of the old timers, it's just clicking on to Zoom, just hitting all the buttons. But to be serious about it, as an artist, you have to use all of the tools that you have available to us. And this Zoom is part of the whole artistic process now. You know, when this virus is over and people move back into the theater, Zoom is an integral part of that because you can reach more people with it. So I think it's the younger people that's in high school, elementary school, and all of that, you know, they're already up on all of this technology and Zoom and all that kind of stuff. And I just think for people like Pam, who's our stage manager, Charlotte, who assists, you know, in making this work and having a quality production. Let me, Brother Quick, let me hear your comments before we close out.
Brother Johnson, thank you again. And Brother Corbin, I just want to say, you know, congratulations to your continued efforts and work. I thank you for providing a platform for young adults like myself, although I don't know if 53 is young these days. but, you know, there's a certain responsibility when you put, you know, your messaging, when you put your work out in front of people, and it's an impression that you want them to walk away with, whether it's a message in the story itself, or if it's a life-changing experience that you want to expose them to that can help enlighten them or uplift them. And I just want to thank you for, you know, being a nurturer of that responsibility and working with a team and a family like Melvin and others that, you know, help you bring that to life. I, you know, am a great fan of you and always promote the plays. I have some ideas in my mind where I want to see you guys even get to a larger level. So I'm going to be working in that efforts to do that. But I just thank you for, you know, the spirituality and what you bring to the screen. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And George, let me have some final comments from you since you can't get through to Candy. Or I would also like to hear from Michelle, if she could say a few words. But George, and talk a little about Lynn, the great artist who have some of her great paintings in Salvador Mori, your wife.
In Salvador Mori, you remember the character saying, the two lovebirds, Eddie saying to her, hey, we could survive on a desert island. We're both artists with a piece of paper and pen. You do your art and I'll write my poems. And so Lynn discovered her passion other than teaching after she retired. She hadn't taken art classes or anything, but she always said over the 41 years she taught, when she retired, she'd like to take an art class and so forth. And I'm thinking she'll put some meat on the stick figures, you know? And she turned out to be pretty damn good.
So excellent.
She really enjoys that. Yeah.
Now, before we let you go, you got to, it's a couple of things that I feel that I would love to have you do. You need to talk about how you met Lynn at Penn State. We missed that chapter. Also, to talk a little, I want to hear, that's Michelle. I want to hear from Michelle. And if we can get Brother Candy on, then I want you to speak for him, talk a little about him, your relationship with him. But first, let's hear from Michelle.
Oh, okay. What do you want to know? What do you want me to say?
My dad is
just really impressed with my father. I didn't realize he was such a good writer. And he's come a long way. And I, like I said, I'm very impressed because I don't have a creative bone in my body that I found yet, at least. And with my dad being, you know, a writer, playwright, and my mother being an artist, it's just really, really impressive. And I'm glad that they have that to work on in their second part of their career, I guess you can say that. And yeah, I'm really enjoying everything that they've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Dorothy. You said it just like.
Yeah.
Okay, George, before we go, you still got to, you left out a chapter.
Yeah.
In the book about Penn State.
Lynn is doing something. I was not a shy retiring type. I was an alpha shop dresser, and I had a couple of girlfriends before I met Lynn at Penn State. And sorry, Lynn. Suddenly, she's here, just like whammo. I had no girlfriends at Penn State at all. Boy, I gotta remember that. Anyway, we both had 8 o'clock classes. She lived in a dorm and lived in a fraternity house. She had to go to this gate. And I would go through the gate at the same time, going the opposite door. And in winter, she wore this kind of heavy blue woolen coat. And I thought she was awfully pretty. And she thought I was awfully forward in pursuing her. It took me quite a while. Is she still here? I would turn it the other way around. Anyway, she bought the fact that she believed me that I owned half of Bermuda, and that helped. But I got her to go to a couple of alpha parties that she had been dating to, not seriously. So we clicked. I think it's partly due my mother being a teacher, her interest in teaching. We had similar interests in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Say something about your brother before we leave here. You know, he's still on mute. You know, say a few comments about it.
My brother, who has a son in the suburbs of Denver, that's where he is right now. He flew in from Bermuda last Thursday. He's going back and forth from the homestead in Bermuda. As I mentioned earlier, I told you about his educational background, his career as a patent attorney. His company, after graduated in mechanical engineering, offered to pay for law school and passing the patent exam if he were to work for them, commit to working for them as a patent lawyer. So that's part of it. But one thing, Candy is an outstanding squash player for his age. He whips kids much younger than he, kids being in their 50s.
Hello.
Oh, we got it.
He plays squash like.
Wait, we got him. We got to hear him. Okay,
I'm going to be brief. I was fortunate enough after working in graduating from school in Toledo, Ohio, to work for a while there. And then I got a job at the Menville Corporation headquarters in Colorado. And I fell in love with the mountains. The office was right there in the foothills of Colorado. I fell in love with the mountains, and I've been coming back and forth ever since. And a man of nature, I'm here now looking for a place to live. And so that's what I'm into right now.
Mile High Denver.
He has hiking buddies, groups, the John Backbrick Club. Mm-hmm. Part of your Black history, you can study that. They go up into the mountains on hikes and so forth. So,
are you a football fan too?
Yeah, I like to. During the normal days, I'm a Bronco fan, obviously. Also, I'm a soccer fan. I used to play soccer in college. I'm also a Bronco fan, but it's not the same without the way it used to be. I just can't get into it without the crowds there.
Well, you guys got a good quarterback getting ready to come your way. But anyway, so, George, I think we're going to close out. Give us a closing comment, George, a little quick closing comments, and then I'm going to mention the Salvador Morning and Wall Street and close this out.
The dance of life is led by the heart. That's the quote I like to keep in mind when I'm writing my place. Mm-hmm. It's here. That's what life is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope everybody come and check this excellent production of Salvador Morning out coming up. And then this is Friday, May the 21st. 2021, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We have an excellent, outstanding cast. So please come check this out. Join us this Friday. Also coming up on June the 1st, we have Black Wall Street coming up. And this is... it'll be projected from New York. Nairobi have a piece in there dealing with that. It's dealing with all of the early historical towns, Jackson Ward, Mount Bayou, Mississippi. My father had a church in Mount Bayou, and all of the early historical towns. So this is Tuesday, June the 1st, 4 o'clock Eastern time. So please come check those out. And I want to extend a special thanks to playwright George Corbin, prolific playwright George Corbin, and all of our special guests. Now you can find a video of this in the next couple of days that will be on my website, it'll be on George's website, my website, dramastage-coonrhyme.org. George is playwrightgeorgecorbin.com. Now, thank you for tuning in to the Coon Rhyme Report, and from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with the song that opens the show, Homeboy by Sunji Ali.
Homeboy.
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 Brothers, there's only one blood. Cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were off, memories, fathers were not favored from the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no
Saint, your daddy died on a shallow street.